Okay, I think I'll get started because I believe there are drinks after this session, and I don't want anyone saying that an Australian got between an American and their beer, so that would be really a bad look for getting back into the country. So, in a break with tradition, I'm going to tell you why you're here before I tell you who I am. And what we're going to talk about for the next hour is why traditional software contracting is a bad idea, isn't a barrier to agility. And if you already think that, I'm going to tell you why it's a really bad idea. We're going to talk a little bit about why we're doing it anyway, because if we don't understand why we're doing it, we can't even hope to stop doing it. And then we're going to talk about the basic principles that should underlie any agile sourcing initiative. And to start off, rather than give you a bio, I'm going to give you a more of a history with my relationship with contracting. I started off as a developer, and while I was actually at university, four of us started up a small company, a full software development firm, mainly building software for the transport industry. And so we literally did work out of our clients' garages. And we didn't call it agile then, but it was very agile in a lot of ways now, because we were all co-located. Whenever you had a clarification on a requirement, you went up and actually got a hold of person, you know, somebody, and should it work like this or work like that? And then we grew, and then we started to do things properly, and I left. And I left to work on multi-million dollar waterfall projects. I was kind of sick of the garage, and I started working mainly with government and military projects. And I learned how to do things really properly. I had, you know, 2167A, you know, hardcore government military contracting projects. And a lot of what I worked on, a lot of it actually over here in the US, was military simulations. And this is where I first encountered game theory in a meaningful way, this idea of trying to figure out ahead of time what things are going to happen to people on either sides. And a second thing happened is that we put together a very large distributed interactive simulator. And we did this in Las Vegas for a US Air Force celebration. And we did what you could call Scrum now. We had a daily stand-up. We coordinated things together. We worked in terms of features that this thing would do. And we put together a really, really impressive distributed war game in the mid-90s. In a very, very short time frame, using a bunch of different suppliers and vendors and things like that. And when we went back to our desk jobs, and we were sort of like 3 years in to a sort of six-year refit of an F-111, which will give you an idea how long ago this was, we were sort of questioning, why did we get so much done for the trade show, and we were halfway through refitting one aircraft, and it was going to take us another 3 years? And we came to the conclusion that, well, we were doing this properly. And the other thing, that wasn't done properly. But one day, I woke up and I decided I wanted to go into private practice. And I left the military and I left working on government projects and I started working for regular software development people. And one thing I discovered is that compared to military and government process, civilian process was really, really lax. They didn't have any process. So I actually started off agile because I thought it was as much process as a civilian could handle. I started off with things like Crystal and XP because I thought it's not much of a process, but it is a process. And we started to roll this out. And then one day I woke up again, sort of slept three times in about the last two decades, and realized that actually this is all we needed. And so I started to work out with lots of internal agile teams, and I did that very successfully. Ended up moving to London, working with a gaming company, and then I wanted to sort of continue in gaming, but gaming was too ethical, so I moved into finance. And it worked really, really well. We used XP to start off with, and XP and Scrum, and we had offshore teams and things like that. And then I moved to a company called Conchengo in the UK that basically outsourced agile developments. We would run Scrum for you. And one of the things that I discovered was that I had spent about 5 or 6 years running Scrum pretty much like this. Everyone's on the same side. Everyone's pointed in the same direction. We're building trading systems for ourselves. And ultimately, everyone's getting paid by the same person. When we started doing it for money, this happened. And the MBA I'd done a couple of years previously And the economics and the contract law all came back and hit me in the head and going, oh my God, we created a moral hazard. And one of the reasons that Agile works so well is it basically goes, we'll deal with this by doing this. We'll just ignore it and hope it goes away. And this is really the heart of this whole, you know, contract customer collaboration over contract negotiation is, we'll get rid of this. And this leads us to the fact that why do we contract at all? We contract because we created this moral hazard. We're in a situation where I want you to do something for me, but our interests aren't aligned. You take risks that I wouldn't take. I'm giving you money. And we have to basically sit there and go, I don't know who you are, right? You're the only person I can see in this whole place because they're shining a light in my face, so you're going to get a lot of attention. And I don't trust you, therefore I want a document that basically describes all the nasty things I can do to you legally if you don't do what I want. And we increased our moral hazard because we outsourced our software development. So in other words, we've created this situation of risk and pain and suffering for ourselves. What are we getting for it? We must be getting something. And if you really boil it down, you're getting one of three things, or hopefully a combination of all three. You're getting expertise you don't have. Maybe you can't actually do it yourself. Right? Maybe you literally don't have the ability to do it. Maybe you can't produce the solution to the sophistication or the scale that you could do in-house. But there's some reason that you're wanting to go to a specialist that can do this better than you. So this is really the gold for me. This is a really good reason to outsource. These people are awesome. We're going to go to there. Other drivers is cost. Now, if you have expertise with specialization, then typically they're going to be able to do it faster and more efficiently than you. But there are other things that drive down cost. Things like they just have an overall lower cost base to their organization or an overall salary base. And this is really what drives offshoring, like actually to India and Romania and places like that, is that even if they're equivalent, we have to pay these guys less. So I'm going to get more value for my software by getting a lower price for it, where somebody else is going to do it. And the last reason is that there's risk inherent in software development. And we either want somebody to share the risk or take it, or we want it to encapsulate it over there somewhere. In fact, I had a client recently that said that they preferred to outsource software they could do in-house because then they had the full recourse of the law, which they can't apply against their own internal teams. So it was like, I can't sue you because you work for us. I can sue him. Right? I feel much more comfortable now. And I go, I don't think your problem's contracting. I think you've got another problem. So when we approach this in different ways to getting these benefits, there's kind of this, we believe different things are going to give us these different benefits. So when we get expertise on a traditional project, what we try to do is we break it down into, we want the expertise of how we're going to build it down, and we want to capture that into a document. And we're going to break it down, and we're going to analyze it, and reduce it, and you know this is going to be done by this. We've got requirement specification, matrices, and all that sort of stuff like that. And then we're going to hand it off, that document, after it's been signed, to people with implementation expertise. So maybe you have the requirements are analyzed, and then somebody else designs it, and then somebody else builds it. But with Agile, we actually start with the idea that somebody will have to build it, and somebody wants it, and we put them all together, and we try and jointly develop the expertise. So we start off with what I call the skills, and we learn what we have to build through building it. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Liz Keogh, who's big in the BDD, but she does this survey and asks people, how long would it take you to do your last software project if you knew everything you know now at the beginning of it? And over the last couple of years, she's come up with the fact that it's about a quarter of the time. So most of what we're doing on a software project is learning. And so with Agile, we basically go, we better start learning from the beginning. So this leads us to our different attitude and preparation. On an Agile project, because we know that we're going to be doing most of our learning through doing and our experiential learning, what we want to do is get going as quickly as we can. So the goal in preparation is to minimize it and start validating our assumptions. Right? What unvalidated assumptions do we have on both sides that we want to move forward? But the traditional idea is that, well, if we're encapsulating expertise, we better get it really thorough and really right and really complete. Right? If I'm specking out you and I forget one of your hands, that's not going to work really well. So this leads to our attitude to scope. On a traditional project, we've decomposed everything down to its component molecules. It's like a transporter in Star Trek. And so if you've got all the component molecules, in the transporter in Star Trek and they don't all make it down to the surface, what have you got? You've got a transporter accident. It's no good, right? Which bit do I actually leave out of you? And this actually leads people to thinking of something else, which is actually if we've got everything and we've got a process that manages everything, then we don't even actually have to outsource it all to a single vendor. We can break it down into maybe you can do this bit cheaper and you can do this bit cheaper and you can do this bit cheaper. In Agile, we have a different view, which we basically say we've probably got it wrong. So we want to break it down into customer digestible chunks. So in other words, we want to basically give you something you would recognize. Breaking it down into things you're going to recognize, and we'll figure out exactly the implementation details just in time. And the Agile attitude to scope, which is, I can't wait to find out how much of this stuff I don't want, because that's stuff I won't have to pay for. Which leads us finally to our attitude to change, which is, well, if we're going to deliver everything, then I may as well optimize everything around efficiency for delivery. That'll make changes costly, so I better discourage and control change. Because I don't want cost because I'm outsourcing to lower cost. On Agile, it's basically like, it's going to be wrong. Right? It's one of the things I love about Lean Startup. Is the first principle of Lean Startup is you're too stupid to know what your customers need. Right? Just straight out there. None of their sort of like respond to change. No, you're stupid. Right? And this is this whole point. This is all going to be wrong, and that's a good thing because it's going to be replaced with something better. So how do we appreciate cost? Cost is very much on people's minds. Now, what happens, economically speaking, is once you've created this beautiful requirement specification, you have created, in effect, a fungible commodity, which means that you can go and get the lowest possible cost of implementation. That's what you're really looking for. You can put it out there in the open market. You can sit there and go, chew each other to death. Who is the most desperate? Who wants to take this? Whereas, coming back to actually some of the stuff that Dean said this morning, is that in Agile, we're actually trying to do things like lower our transaction costs. The transaction costs are the managing the template, are the reviewing the reviews, doing all the project management on the outside, maximizing the work not done, the stuff we don't have to build, and actually trying to finish it while we've still got some money in the kitty. So there's a very different approach. Which leads us to this kind of game in vendor selection, which is basically who's the cheapest as the primary driver, but the cheapest better be worth suing, because that's how actually we're managing our risk. At Conchanga, we once lost a job because the client said, we know you can do it, but the contract value is worth more than we would get for basically liquidating your company. And we were like, what? And there are procurement departments out there that basically actually start off with that, right? Who could we sue to get the requisite money back, and then who's the cheapest out of these? And this one again, who will agree to our conditions? Who will agree to the ridiculous things? And the response to this on the vendor side is, pick us, we're cheap. We've done work for all your competitors. You'll get exactly the same thing as all your competitors have. That'll give you a competitive edge. And also, we'll agree to anything to get the job. Once we've got the job, well, that's when we move into what's called post-contractual opportunism. We suddenly get a little bit disagreeable. Agile, this has been up to date. It's something you can feel you can work with, right? It's really about the relationship and establish a long-term relationship. It's an interesting thing. These are not one-shot games anymore. If you're really serious about agile contracting, you've got to think about return business. You've really got to think about the long game, not just for the, you know, not just it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, not just the release, but actually working with this customer for a long period of time. And the attitude of an agile development shop is, we're not cheap, we're awesome, right? Made in America. Pay us what we're worth and you won't regret it. So this leads to a different view on time. Now, this is the one thing that blows my mind. Is that when I look at the time and money, because this is done by stuff outside the project, so many clients think time spent before the project starts doesn't really count. Right? It's gone to legal, it's gone to procurement, it's gone somewhere else. I don't know what's happened to it. It's not coming out of my budget. I can't see it. However, when as soon as the developers start working, is that every half an hour counts. Right. But this is the managerial attitude to it. So if you can come back again to Dean's point that no one's told Agile managers about Agile, is that they go, but this is what we have to do, right? And it's not developers doing this. It's like serious people, like lawyers, right? People with suits and ties and fancy offices and things like that, that couldn't possibly be charging us too much money. Whereas, rather than... It's actually one of the first agile contracting sessions we ever did. They basically go, never forget, lawyers charged by the 6-minute increment. They have no incentive for this negotiation to end early. And we prefer to save time in agile. Right? It's not spending time. It's not investing up front. It's just like, you know, what are we trying to save? It's this whole cost of delay thing, right? What is it costing us, right, to do this? While you're getting this this specification exactly right, what are you costing on doing? If you want a really, really simple example of cost of delay, think about if you've ever got any friends that will not buy anything other than the most perfect, bestest electronic product. Anyone got one of those? You know, if they're going to buy a digital camera, it has to be the best ones. I had a friend, he's got kids growing up and had to get the best digital camera. Right? Took him 9 months to figure out which digital camera to buy, but he got the best one. What was the cost of that?
9 months of photos.
9 months of photos, right? What was the difference between the Canon he picked and the Nikon he could have picked? Is it worth that? I mean, that's the whole thing. 9 months of photos of developing children versus I might have made a suboptimal decision. We're doing it every day. Right? It's insane. So this leads us to how we treat people. If you've got this fungible commodity, then it doesn't really matter who it develops, as long as, you know, as long as they do what you tell them to do. Which leads vendors to go, and, well, we always get hired, pressed on price, so we better find the cheapest people we can find. Right? So it pushes you to getting cheap people. Whereas in Agile, it's, you know, this has been the theme of today. It's all about people building your stuff. And you want people that you can meet, you want people you can trust, you want people you can work with. And we want awesome motivated people. We want to hire them like Mitch was talking about. Just go and find people that can do what we want and do they have a good cultural fit. So we want to hire people and look after them. And if you think about the move from HR to people operations, you have companies that are actually having a look at what their churn is, why people are churning, how much that's costing them in rehire, and then factoring that back into it's worthwhile getting rid of this problem. So where is our profits coming from? Basically, bargaining, right? I'm going to get something, I'm going to get the cheapest price, and I'm going to get additional profit out of what the software was ever going to do for me. If we think it's going to give us a lifetime value of $5 million, and we manage to get it an extra $1 million cheaper, then that's found money. And the way this works, if anyone's been on the vendor side, is that basically you price it to win the job, and then you'll make it all back on the change request, making sure that at no point during the contract that you ever deliver what the client wanted. The game is absolutely to deliver to the letter of the contract and not at all the spirit. It's basically sit there all the way through because you will lose money until the end of this system. Right? Whereas we're trying to make profit here out of the software. It's a radical strange idea that if we actually made valuable software and got it out there early and worked with the miracle of compound interest, then we might actually make money directly out of the software as opposed to side effects, which is what we're doing down here. We've ended up people trying to treat this almost like a stock market. And ultimately, I think the problem is that because we spend so much time in transaction costs and increasing the contract delay on upfront analysis and contract negotiation, we have to get a good deal on the software because otherwise the software isn't worth doing. Do you know what I mean? We're actually adding so much to it, we have to go and make you pay for it. So a genuine conversation with a genuine client, genuine government client, might not surprise you. They've been negotiating this project, which was supposed to take 3 years, and they've been negotiating for 14 months. And I came in and I talked to this guy, and I said, what are you so frightened of? What is it that you are so frightened of that's taking you 14 months to negotiate a contract with the supplier that you've chosen, right? They're not. This is not tender. And he looks at me straight in the face, and he goes, late delivery. Which is 20 years of consultant training comes back here, and all my facial muscles freeze. I take a few deep breaths. And I replied, I said, so what you've done is you've exchanged the certainty of starting 14 months late for the risk that it might deliver a couple of months late. And he looks at me again, he goes, it sounds bad when you put it that way. On risk. Because we've distilled everything into this perfect godlike nugget of requirements, and we got an awesome deal on it, then the risk is not getting that thing, right? We've defined perfection, and if I don't get perfection, then we've bundled all our risk into one big blob, and we like big blobs, they create big queues. And a fixed price, fixed scope contract's awesome, because I basically take this and then I hand it to the vendor. Now it's all your fault. Whereas Agile, we basically go, until we built it, it's an unvalidated assumption. If it's an unvalidated assumption, it's a risk. And what we really want to do is get rid of this risk. Are we building the right thing? Are we building it the right way? You've heard it all before. But the idea is that there's actually risks out there we can think about, and there's risks out there we won't think about, but what we want to do is hunt them down and kill them. Right? And we're holding a big risk every time we have got something that we've built that we haven't delivered that it's just not going to work out. And because of our view on risk, then our traditional one is, how far through are you doing what you said you were going to do? Right. Whereas the traditional response is, actually, the traditional vendor is going, well, how often is the customer complaining? I've actually seen that. They have a complaint burn down. Right. How many times has the customer complained about something? And this as well, how many change requests do you think they'll need? In other words, how much money do you think we're actually going to, so they actually have a change request burn up, right? And again, working software, primary measure of progress on the customer side. And this comes back to this long game, right? How strong is our relationship with the customer, and how much have we delivered of stuff that they can use? Right? Connecting back that, aligning up the incentives and collapsing the moral hazard. And leads to very different attitudes to trust because of this. Right. Is over here, the contract is a replacement for trust. Over here, trusting people is seen as an opportunity to make money. Right. Trust really is an opportunity to make money, because if you have a look at some of Dyer's work on transaction costs, in large projects, they're the majority of where the money goes. So most of it goes into the project management. Most of it goes into all the documentation. Most of it goes into the legal fees. And if you pull all that away and actually just sit there and develop the software, there's a hell of a lot more money left over. Right. So you end up with this very adversarial thing. When you abdicate trust, it atrophies like a muscle. Right? Trust is a muscle. You build it. And if you basically sit there and go, oh, I don't have to trust anybody, we've got this document that describes all the horrible penalties that will happen when trust breaks down, so you don't have to trust them because we've got this weapon in our pocket. Which leads to how we look at termination. Agile, we like to terminate early because it either means that we've discovered that we're throwing money down a pit, or it means that we finished earlier, right? Either way, we're actually making money or we've stopped hemorrhaging money. Over here, termination is kind of like mutually assured destruction. It's a threat and no one ever uses it. Because if you terminate a traditional project halfway through, you haven't got anything. And you also look bad because that meant that little perfect ball of stuff you created, maybe that wasn't perfect. And that's not really going to get you a good reference to go to the new place, right? Suppliers basically know you don't mean it. And so ultimately, this leads to our different success criteria, which is, did they do what you said they were going to do? Do we get paid the full amount of the contract? And do we have years of lucrative change requests? In other words, have we finally got through our 6 years of purgatory and into the Agile bit? Right, change request, change request, change request. And of course, Agile success is, A, it's doing what we needed. And on the vendor side, we've got more work and we maybe got a bonus for delivering. So our expectations as we go into the development is that, you know what, it's going to go wrong. Years of experience have told us it's going to go wrong, so we need to focus on the failure so we know whose fault it is. I don't know if anyone else sees this, but I see people do so much focus on expecting it's going to go bad, they don't even countenance the fact that it actually could possibly work out. Right. And so the vendors make sure that from day one, nothing will stick to them. Wasn't my fault. Don't do it in writing. Be careful what you say. Right. And the Agile expectation should be, well, it might, if we don't know them, it's going to take a little while to get to know them, but, you know, it's going to be awesome. The fundamental assumption behind all of this is that we can describe what needs to be done to get our desirable outcomes so completely it doesn't matter who does it. That's the fundamental assumption that underlies traditional contracting. However, if you only define one way to win, the universal balance of that is you just create an infinite number of ways to fail. Remember that. People go, oh, if we get this on scope, on time, on budget, well, if we don't get any of those, everything else is now a failure, right? Success is like a pinpoint in the eons of probability points. If that doesn't convince you, I'm going to, warning science, I'm going to basically show you why this can't ever work, basically. This is a quote from Milgram and Roberts, and this is from a classic textbook, and it talks about the fact that actually one of the reasons that contracting engagements fail is because we can't write a sufficiently detailed contract. Right? Fairly obvious statement. And I'm going to prove that trying to is pointless. Who's heard of the Kinevan framework? One, two, three, four, couple. So Kinevan is what's called a sense-making framework. This is a Welsh word, it's not Sinefin. And it looks like this, basically. It's meant to be like that, don't ever draw it as a cross. And it's broken into two major domains, which are broken into subdomains. And on this side, we have what we call the ordered space, the ordered level of problems. And this is broken further down into two subdomains. So we've got the simple, which is, or the known space, and this is really easy to understand. Cause and effect is obvious, predictable, and infinitely repeatable. So I've got a bottle of water here, right? What's going to happen as I continue to change? It's going to spill, right? You go and get a bottle of water, it'll do the same thing. It's going to do the same thing tomorrow. It's going to do the same thing tomorrow after that. We can even measure the angle at which it comes out. Do you know what I mean? And there's all sorts of simple things. You know what I mean? I can go up. If I do this, what's going to happen? He's going to get wet. The session's going to end early, right? And it's really easy. We understand this. This is the first thing our brain, basically cause and effect, gets to understand. Then we move into what's called the complicated. And this is what we call the knowable. And cause and effect is separated here. It's still directly related, but you've got to kind of think it through. Do you know what I mean? So it's getting to the point where it's separated off space or time, and if you sat down and worked on it, you could think it through. And expertise is a shortcut to doing this. So again, growing up in country Australia, when your car broke, you went and got a manual on your car, and you got all your mates around, you got some beer, you pulled apart the car on the front of your lawn in your house, and that's as far as it went. And when I grew up, I discovered the existence of somebody called mechanics. And they actually knew how the car worked already, so they could go in and tell you. And we have mechanics, we have doctors, and a lot of the world works here. And if you really want to understand this, if you think about power switches, if you think about the power switches in your house, simple, right? Connect it, connects it up to the mains, goes to the white light, goes to the wire. Think about the power switch on your laptop. Unless somebody's got a laptop from 1987, it's not connected to the power, is it? It's just another button, and it runs some software which does some other bits and pieces. But if you gave it to your mum or your sister that doesn't understand about computers, they'd just go, oh, it's a power switch. Right? So it's a perceptual thing. Over here, we have what's called unordered domains. And we mean unordered like we mean the undead. They're like zombies or vampires. They exhibit signs of life and death. There's order there, but most people can't perceive it. The domain we're mostly interested in is the complex domain. And over here, cause and effect is only coherent in retrospect. So we move from causal to coherent. And what causes a lot of people to not understand that this exists is that retrospective coherence means that after something's happened, you can make a plausible explanation for why it did. So if you think about a project retrospective, and we go up to you and we ask you, why did that go wrong? And you go, well, for this reason, and this reason, this reason, this reason. You've got a really good logical train of reasoning. And then I go to you, and you ask you the same question, and you have completely different answers, all the same. And I go to you, all the same. They're all different answers. It's a really good leading indicator of a complex situation is that when everyone's got a completely logical set of reasons, you're all wrong. because you were trying to drag it back over here so that you could actually deal with the situation. Anyone's got sort of like toddler-age children or has children? Yeah. Have you ever noticed that they watch the same movie again and again and again and again? It's because they're trying to make the world look like this. They get tremendous comfort out, I know what's going to happen, I know what's going to happen, I know what's going to happen, right? And this is kind of how the human mind develops, right? So if you ever have a manager that basically goes, no, it's obvious and simple, right? Just imagine him as a toddler, right? You say, your brain didn't develop past four, did it? And so this is the thing, it's not repeatable, because we go and do all of those things, it won't create the same result. For completeness, there's another place called chaos, and no one knows what the hell's happening down there, even after it happens, right? If you can perceive cause and effect here, there's an opportunity for an extreme amount of money, because you can see patterns that other people can't. So this sounds interesting. Oh, and lastly, there's only this center area is basically the zone of not agreeing which zone you're in. So you can't move forward if you're in here because basically somebody's going, it's really, really obvious, and some people's going, we might have to think through, and some people are going, I don't think we really know what's going on. Now, where this becomes useful and where I think this is far more useful than other models like Stacey is the fact that we can do things with this information. So once we've actually made sense of the work we're doing, we can have a look at what sort of strategies we can use to manage it. And if we go down the simple, it's very easy. This is best practice. One right way to do it, just do it. That's how McDonald's works. Just do that, and then do it again, and then do it again. Up here, this is the zone of the analytical reductionist method, or current good practices. This means that while you're thinking through and executing the answer to the problem didn't change. Over here, you've got to basically allow the solution to co-evolve. In other words, we don't necessarily know what problem we're trying to solve until we start to solve it. So we might start off with an idea about what we want to solve, but we don't really know what the real problem is until we start to move it. And you have this idea of co-evolving with agents. So in other words, the people that are solving your problem get to understand it. And you can basically reduce these down into these little mantras, right? Sense, categorize, respond. Look at the problem. Pick which one of your standard solutions will work, do it. Look at the problem, think about it for a bit, execute what you thought about. As soon as we cross the Rubicon, no amount of looking at it is ever going to do anything. In fact, as to reference the Poppendick quote from this morning, your customers will change their mind while you're looking at the problem. There's a bunch of different ways to look at Mary's quote, and that's the fact is that customers' minds change not because they're fickle, but because their needs change. Right. Who's got a touchscreen device? Less than I thought, but quite a lot. Who thought that they'd need a touchscreen device 20 years ago? Who needed a touchscreen device, right? We needed DOS. Then we needed Windows 3.1. We needed Windows 95, right? We laugh at these things now, but at the time, they were awesome. I was looking at my new smartphone, and I had this really sad feeling because I thought, I now know the day where I'm going to look at this and think it's lame. Right? So what you have to do is interact with the system, see how the system interacts with you, and then base your response on that. Right? And lastly, there's ways of managing these domains effectively. Over in chaos, well, yeah, okay. In the simple system, this is, again, like a McDonald's, right? You want strong centralized control. One person knows what everyone else should be doing. No one else really has to know anything. They're just being watched, right? Complicated, this is very traditional project. Place for everything and everything in its place, right? All very strongly rigid. When you move over here, you have to move into what the military calls commander's intent, which is that I'll tell you what I like and what I don't like. I won't tell you how to do it. You need strong teams that go and do things. Right? So this is this idea of it's domain appropriate to have teams of people that know each other's strengths and weaknesses but are being given light touch direction. Right? This is good, that's bad, this is good, that's bad. And so if you've got a complex problem, you can't describe it in complete detail. Kinevan came from knowledge management. Kinevan came from you can't write it down. It's not possible. And basically, you can only co-evolve it with the people that are building it. They have to get better at understanding your problem, which means that our fundamental assumption in waterfall contract is wrong. It does matter who builds it. And we should be focusing on expertise, not cost, in vendor selection. Because cost is driving us to get dumb people that don't care. Right? Again, it sounds bad when I put it that way. Right? What are we looking for? What's the most important thing in this contract? We want to make sure it's being built by dumb people that don't care. Right? Say it with me. It sounds bad. So these analytical reductionist techniques that we've been using are great for simple and complicated problems, right? They're great for painting your house, and they're great for building laser pointers, and they're great for ordering nachos. But they just don't work. When you get to this, how is all this stuff gonna put together? How are we gonna build the next generation of software? And so what happens when people go, oh, the requirements weren't good enough? It's not that we're not doing it right, they're failing us. It's the wrong tool for the job. You just simply can't do it that way. Good news, most agile frameworks unconsciously basically do this. I've got another session which proves that sort of, if you do things like Scrum, if you think about Scrum, it's basically like, what are we gonna do? How did that work out? Sprint planning and change it. This is not too far away from PDCA. And a lot of agile frameworks, they didn't start out necessarily to be, I mean, if you talk to Ken, he'll talk about Scrum with complex problems. But now we know more about complexity, we understand why agility works. So in the second decade of using agility, we understand more why it works, when it works, and why it works in situations where waterfall just didn't work. So, no problems. Unless we basically take our awesome agile, and we take some sort of like flex cord and stuff like that and some handcuffs, and we change it all up, and we stick it inside a traditional contract. So why are we doing this? I have three hypotheses. Just like Dean said, did we let anyone else know we changed the rule book? Right. The managers don't know, the lawyers sure as hell don't know, the procurement people don't know, the HR people don't know. Right. A lot of organizations, no one else knows. Right. The awesome thing about Agile is it's so focused on software. Right. Biggest problem we're having now with Agile is it's so focused on software. You can't talk to it about Agile. This is where Lean is useful, right? Because you can talk to people about Lean because they don't go, oh, it's that crappy software thing, right? Result is that a lot of people see it as like a construction project, except people have actually worked on a construction project, which knows that construction projects don't work like this either, but they think it's definable and predictable. It's got the word engineering in it. Engineering is definable and prediction. Loads of time's going to happen before anything's worth looking at. We shouldn't pay people for years. Anything you deliver is kind of just irrelevant. You know what I mean? If you deliver me kind of a hole in the ground, I don't really care. And early termination represents a crisis to be avoided. Because again, you think about a construction project. If you end up with a hole in the ground or half a building or bits and pieces all over the place, that's a massive issue, right? If you think about some of the funding crises in hotels in Vegas, is that it'll take you much, much longer. And customer involvement's all front-loaded. Tell us what you want and we'll come back and, well, actually, tell us what you want in 6 years and we'll come back in 12 and give them to you. Right. And so you end up with this sort of management with Agile, right? Fire and forget. Here's our bottle of requirements. Off you go. Right? They need to manage it like this. Right. So there's an expectation that needs to be there from the beginning that they're going to have to be involved all the way through. They're not deferring their risk anymore. Second reason is actually legal reasoning itself. And legal reasoning is all about following a causal chain. It's all about this led to this led to this, an unbroken set of reasons why we get from A to B. And it's actually a requirement that a contract may not be indeterminate, right? It may not be indeterminate, trifling, illegal. Anyone remember the fourth one? It's not relevant, but there is a fourth one. But these are one of the criteria for a contract. And legal reasoning is also based on precedent rather than pure logic. So you've got this weird idea that you can't actually think through it logically. You have to think through it logically based on what happened in past events. Now, again, this isn't so bad for murdering people and stealing things, which haven't changed, But if you think about software, the way we've developed software has changed. And the law itself changes very slowly. It's always behind the code. This is basically saying precedent will rule until basically the courts decide to change it. So the law itself is going to be about 20 years at least before you actually see the law itself supporting Agile really easily. Which means that everything that happens in contract law happens over here. This is the definable causal side, and our problems live over here. Bummer. Right? Which means that when you're writing an Agile contract, you don't want the bits that are going to evolve in here. Right? You want to lock down the frameworks and the idea, what you know, the bits that are solid, that's fine, but it can't lock this stuff down because it's almost guaranteed to break. Right? Now, lawyers themselves, this is actually out of a legal statute, is that they are actually legally bound to basically use the law for their client's benefit to gain them an advantage. They're supposed to sit there and they're supposed to think about all the nasty things that's going to happen. So they focus. They actually do this kind of like mental war game with the other lawyer, and they play for this tit-for-tat thing with the legal contract. Right? You put that clause in, I'll put this clause in, and they move through there. And they basically focus on the worst possible situation. They're very, very conservative. They're going to go with contract forms that they've used in the past because their definition of success is different to yours. They care less about the primary contract and more about the fact that if legal action did occur, were you protected? Right? They think the unthinkable is something. Now, this leads to this. Which is, we want to start off negotiating a contract, and we'll have a set of outcomes. Right? Customer wants this, the supplier wants this. Some of these outcomes are actually legal. And we begin to negotiate, which means that we begin to change our positions. Notice the law doesn't move. And then eventually, we kind of really change our positions, and we strike a deal. So this is the idea, this is what I really, really want, this is what I want, and this is this kind of mutual zone. Right? So far, so good. But a good lawyer will make it look like this, but actually be like this. This is really what they're actually trying to do. Right? This is the whole idea, is that actually it's in our benefit from the beginning. Right? This is what's actually happening. Now, the actual outcome of this to an Agile project is really, really interesting. Right? And I call it Groucho Marx syndrome. Because what happens is that I've just made a deal, and I've really put you on the back foot. I've tricked you, I've cajoled you, I've lowered you, and now I've lost respect for you. So from the get-go of the contract, we end up with a situation of going, this guy's an idiot because he signed our contract. And it dominates the relationship. So how do you think the vendor feels at this point? I'm going to use a visual aid. Customer collaboration, anyone? Right. Educate and involve them. No, seriously. Weirdly enough, if you sit down and talk to a lawyer about Agile, they will sit up and they will get very angry, and they'll get very angry that no one told them about any of this stuff. This couple of key points to tell them. Early termination, the thing that they're probably trying to stop, is actually a good thing, right? And it's not a disaster, because we want to keep our code clean and our increments value. So if we stop a software project halfway in the middle of it, even because we don't like what's happening, we still have a code base that somebody else can pick up. Right? And that is something you can contract for. Right? Coding quality standards, that sort of stuff. That's something they can nail down. Right? Tell them we no longer believe that we can actually describe everything we want. Right? So in other words, we want to basically start these things off as hypothesis. Tell them that not getting stuff can be a good thing. And tell them, and they won't believe this bit, that we're no longer wanting to see an unfair advantage. We're actually wanting to start off with a collaborative mindset. And that you're really looking for trust to build profits, right? By reducing the transaction costs. The economic term for this is we're trying to create a larger surplus out of the deal. So we're trying to take the same amount of money and get rid of the transaction costs and create a larger amount of money we can draw from. And the last reason comes to this. And this comes from a couple of years of helping people with Agile contracts, which is, I don't understand this. Agile benefits the customer, right? Far more than it does the vendor. But customers, I don't get called by customers much. I get called by vendors. Go, how do I talk my customers in to going agile? They don't want to do it. Is anyone in this situation? And I came up with, again, three hypotheses for why these things happen. It got to do with the fact that the supplier motivations go like this. You either have a genuine desire for customer success. So in other words, you are pushing agile because you know this is going to make them happy, right? It's like getting your kids to eat their vegetables, right? I know you don't want to eat the broccoli now, but when you don't have rickets, you'll thank me, right? This is a slightly uncharitable explanation, which is actually they might just mindlessly be jumping on the latest bandwagon and they have no idea what they're asking the customers to do, in which case they probably can't explain it either. Or the last one, which is what I think all the customers think, is it seems like a really good way to get off the hook. Beginning, oh, you're not going to know what you're going to get, you're not going to know when you're going to get it because it's going to be agile, it's all a mystery, but we won't be involving you either. And I think this is what the customers see, but I also genuinely think it's what a lot of suppliers are actually doing it. They basically see it as a way to get time and materials. They see it as a way to get off the hook for these low-price contracts. And this creates what's called a market for lemons, which means that customers don't trust anybody, because they've got this asymmetric information, which is they don't know really why you're doing this. And ultimately, the solution is promoting the transparency. The thing I want to bring in about this is that the secondhand car industry has solved this problem. This was about, the market for lemons was about the secondhand car industry, and they solved it. I've forgotten the name of the company now, but it was an American company where they basically sit down with you and go through the service history of every single car. Right, and they go through the incentives for the salesman and everything like that, and you can solve this distrust in secondhand car sales through basically sitting there. There's nothing here. There is a microphone back there, though. Right. So to finish up, because I realise I'm endangering the beer, the fundamental principles of agile contracting are protect the interests of the parties, and most importantly, continuously build trust in the relationship. Right? This is actually what you're trying to do, because continuously building trust continuously builds profit. Customer interests are already well served by Agile. Right? Incremental delivery, clean code base, low barrier to exit. So really the answer here is to force people to do Agile. So if you think about Agile contracting forms like money for nothing, change for free, it's got that first fundamental problem with it, which is, oh, you only get that if you do Scrum. Problem is that a contract clause doing Scrum, any lawyer is going to be able to throw you out of court because they're going to be able to find a definition of Scrum somewhere which suits their own purpose. Right. But you can actually sort of serve that by contracting that we will get these things and we will do these things. Supplier interests are actually the harder thing to contract for, because a lot of suppliers incur costs. Right? If I get a contract for a couple of years, then I might bring on additional staff, I might incur costs where to put them, and almost more importantly, there's opportunity costs worth for alternate work. So if I decide to reject another contract and you terminate mine 3 months into what I thought was going to be a 4-year deal, that's my interest gone. This is what I was saying. I don't understand why any vendor wants to do this. And so this is where you want measures of compensation for early delivery. So in other words, you get sort of like a bumped up margin. You don't get paid for the whole of it, but there will be a compensatory measure in here. Mm-hmm. However, if you're one of these hot new agile consultancies that have, again, these cross-functional people like Dean says, is that if you don't have to incur these commitment costs, that's a really big competitive advantage for you as a supplier. And I actually think this is a massive opportunity in the market, because a lot of people are basically traditional consultancies. They do a mixture of agile and waterfall, so they're kind of stuck with the same resourcing model. And so they basically have to do these traditional style contracts. They go, oh, yes, I'll be very, very agile, except I want all the old benefits from Waterfall for myself as well. So you don't have to tell me anything, but I get fixed amount of money for variable scope. And, oh, are you having trouble convincing our customers? I wonder why. So here is how to do it properly, not in clause by clause form, because I'd give you Commonwealth law and that would be wrong. But number one is remove the inhibitors before trying to add the incentives. A lot of people go, oh, I need to figure out how to set this thing up to incentivize everyone to do the wrong thing. That's no good if you haven't removed all the things that were making you do bad things in the first place. You're going to get more benefits by removing the incentives to do the wrong things than you are by adding things to be agile as well. So we're back to deliver on the entire contract unless somebody changes their mind, in which case we don't know what's going to happen, right? You'll end up with a big, ugly mess. So basically, you'll spend a lot of time doing this in a lot of situations before you come around to this side. You want to build trust through transparency, and you encourage transparency by increasing safety. And you encourage safety by protecting confidentiality. So you've got to make people safe to feel transparent. Because if you think about the people who you most trust, think about them, their friends, family, right? What do they know about you?
How you act when you're drunk.
Yeah. They know the real you, don't they? And there's a massive psychological link between, it's much better standing here, between vulnerability, being vulnerable to somebody, and actually trusting them, because there's a direct connection in your motor neurons, basically. You sit there and you go, if I've made myself vulnerable to you, therefore I must trust you. And if you think about the language, right, this is what we're doing. So if I'm intimidated by this guy, right, I'm going to physically hold myself like this so that my arms are ready, right? If I trust him, right, and actually this is weirdly uncomfortable, because you're sitting there going, I've got my thorax open, I've got everything open here, right? So you want to basically work on the idea of something you can contract for. You can't contract for trust. You can't contract for trust, but you can contract for confidentiality, and you want to promote confidential information. You want to change the language, right? Every human conflict, we've demonized the enemy by giving them a name like Hun or Gook or Nip. Right? Words that are now racial slurs because they were designed to make us think of people as less than human. So compare these two. The difference between the system shall, the typical thing, to our current hypothesized implementation is. Bit wordy, but it's very clear that this is what we think we should do, but we know we could be wrong. My favorite is one I introduced into a customer a couple of years ago. Bugs became this incredibly emotionally violent thing. Oh, I found some bugs in your software. And we replace that to, I have an opinion about the current state of the software. And all of a sudden, rather than being defensive, people went, okay, I'm interested in your opinion. Because by saying an opinion, I'm automatically sitting there and going, you know, it's my opinion, may not be your opinion. And find out what words have emotional valence with you and your customers that are setting them off, and then change them. Reviews aren't enough. They're really not, because you end up with this situation where, why do they keep on showing us stuff that's half finished? You've got to get them to accept the software. They've got to take some ownership of it, because there's a thing called prospect theory, which means that we value something ridiculously more higher if we own it than if we're just looking at it. Right? So if I was going to offer my awesome green laser pointer to somebody, right, the amount you would pay for it is pretty much never going to be the amount I'd let it go for, because I've got sort of emotional attachment for it. I've got the inconvenience of things like that. So you want to leverage this to make sure that people are really buying into it, because if they take change of it, you're not going to end up in that ridiculous situation where, oh, how do I contract for changing something that happened in sprint 3 when it's sprint 77? You want to measure a level up. This has got to do with this idea of this complex systems, which is, the problem is if you measure the wrong thing at the measure level down, you're going to create, you don't know what you're going to do. Because people are going to sit there and go, if I get paid or promoted based on this metric, then I'm going to fulfill this metric. And the only way to make sure you've got all the right metrics is to bundle them all up in a great big thing. Tool would be good. I was actually thinking TFS could be awesome at this. And basically measure these aggregated metrics, because you're more likely to catch everything. This is kind of what we're doing with done, right? In other words, we're not going to measure you on bugs, we're going to measure you on software. Right? While you're doing it, you want to contractually distinguish the informational from the performance metrics. There's a lot of informational metrics in Agile. Right? You don't want those to be performance metrics, because what's that going to do to your transparency? I start measuring bugs and contracting you on bugs, what's going to happen to the bugs? They'll go to zero. What'll actually happen to the bugs in the software? They're not going to go to zero, are they? But they... Again, genuine story from a project about 15 years ago. We got a letter from the Air Force saying that we were not closing discrepancy reports at a fast enough rate, and we were going to get penalised. And I learnt my first project management trick, which was you close the discrepancy report by opening another one. Change the wording and going, I've closed this one, and the reporting metrics goes, and people will game any low-level metric you give them. Right? And you want to aggregate them before measuring. And don't be afraid to do this. Take these objective measures and inform this objective. I want to remind everybody that velocity means speed plus direction. If you're using story points or whatever, that's going to tell you how much stuff you've got, but who can tell you whether you're going in the right direction? Who's the one person that can tell you? Customer, right? So velocity is not this arbitrary number of, oh, we built you XD million points of software. Awesome, I wanted XD million points of software. Right? Well, I want to be able to do these things. So you don't know your velocity until the customer tells you. Right? It doesn't matter how fast you're rowing if you're going in the wrong direction. When you talk about dates, stop people giving this date here. This is what's called a risk diagram or a probability chart. This is an example of basically how long something's going to take. Again, you might need tools to calculate this. What happens is people sit there and go, well, it's going to be absolutely impossible to do it in a year, 2 years. Oh, we'll probably get it done in this amount of time. And then they go, it'll be there. It's called the nano probability date because the date before it, it was impossible. Which means if you look at all the probabilities of how long it's going to actually take, well, this is one of the least likely dates that it's ever going to go happen. But this is what happens when people give single dates. Right? I wouldn't even recommend you gave people this date. They won't like this date, so don't give them that one. Right? I would get them used to actually understanding schedules in terms of this sort of format. And you can aggregate these mathematically validly. In fact, I don't know if Don Reinerson's book's got a lot of maths in it. It actually may have the maths behind this. But you can get tools to do this and do things like Monte Carlo analysis to move multivariate variables together. But this is transparency, right? This really means these things. And if it's too wide, that's a great example for a conversation with a customer, right? What's causing this variance, right? Not what's causing it to be late. What's causing this massive amount of variance and whose risk is it? You want to start a step backwards. Right. Even if you've got to work with the details, you need a sight line back to the original objectives. Why are we actually doing this? Right? If all you've got is just do this, you've lost. Right? You can bundle them. Most suppliers, again, won't sit there and go, oh, well, I'm not going to take responsibility for you meeting your needs because you've got to direct me. But bundling objectives with the requirements is quite nice in work packages. So the idea is we are trying to get this metric. This is the business behavior we want. This is our hypothesized changes. And what this is great for is it can actually have a contractual mandate that if basically the software is not producing the changes, then basically you have to fire off a collaboration session with a customer. Right? You can bundle them together. Basically, this is kind of like having your cake and eating it too. Do the same thing for dates. If you're given a fixed date, know why. And this will help you make prioritization decisions for the backlog. Do you really need this for this particular event, right? When we're moving things around. And it also adds purpose and urgency for the vendor team. If they know why the date's there rather than just because, they might actually care, right? They'll begin to actually care. One of the best projects I ever worked on was getting a retail client on date for Halloween. And the two most spectacular things that I think drove that project to excellence was, A, when we kicked it off, our customer said to the developers, and they remembered this to the end, is spend it like it's your own money. Right? We've got $1 million, don't spend it all, and basically had this idea of, like, we are trying to save most of this money. Second thing is, if you're a fancy dress company, what's your primary goal? Where's your big money?
Sell hours.
Sell hours. Fancy dress, like costumes, dressing up like Batman. It's Halloween. So again, you've got a deadline that everyone understands. And so when you're on the team and they're running problems, they understand that they need to be on by a date for a reason, and it really is a drop-dead date. Right? It's not a kind of an arbitrary deadline. It really is kind of like somebody's working. And it really, people will buy into it. Right? I do this. This is basically compressing all that together. If you aggregate all your termination, your penalty clauses, get rid of liquidated damages, just go straight to termination. Right? Basically, we're going to run as normal, or we're going to end the contract. Nice, binary, bright legal line. Only thing I get you to do is differentiate early termination due to early delivery, yay, to no, you did a really bad job, we're getting rid of you and getting another supplier. Right? That's what you want to make sure it's clear on. But this is actually the ultimate thing of measuring up and thinking a step backwards. But you want to think a step forward as well, because that makes you think about, well, what next? We wanted the software. So if we terminate you, we've then got to do this and this and this and this and this and this. And so when you think a step forwards in the step, that will prevent people from actually terminating early a lot of the time, because they're going to sit there and go, did they mean to screw up, or is that just the way it happens? There's a very strange thing that we do with people we don't trust, which is we assume they meant us malice. Do you know what I mean? If a team doesn't deliver, we sit there and go, oh, bloody, they could have delivered. They could have done everything I wanted. They just didn't. As opposed to, maybe that was just reality. Maybe that's the only thing that could have happened. And let's talk about how to prevent that happening. Right. And don't push it. Not everyone's ready. Not everyone's able. Some people are contractually or there's actually like legislation that they are, you know, government departments have to have a certain system. And not every software problem is complex either. Don't become a kind of a complexity hippie and go around, man, I'm going to go out and get a glass of wine and it's really too complicated, so I'm going to have to probe all the wine and then sort of like figure out how I feel. Not everything's complex, which is why we have Kinevan. Kinevan is a way of actually figuring out where things live, so we can work out what we need to iterate on and what we can just go ahead and do. And you can do fixed price for Scrum. It's dead easy. And it's even better than Waterfall. Right? You just basically put it all into a backlog. You still have to spend a lot more time up front. You still have to mitigate a lot of risk traditionally. But if you do start off with fixed price from Scrum, you can iterate towards agility. Start off with just getting them more involved, right? It's like a new puppy, sort of play with their feet so that when you clip their claws, they won't get so upset. And you being more involved with them, asking them questions, why do you want to do this, right? Avoid any concept of this. A lot of people, they basically take their old Waterfall habits and make them worse with Agile. So it's like, I'm going to have lots of penalty clauses. Good. Agile gives me a reason to have penalty clauses every 2 weeks. Right? It's not sprint judgment. Right? Review and retrospective. Right? It's not the daily beat up either. Right? It's not basically sort of what you should have done yesterday, what's wrong with you, and why you're ugly. Right? That's not how you do it. And my suggestion is you actually start them off with reordering. You get their fixed backlog, and then you get them used to the idea that they can change the order around. You still have fixed price, you have fixed scope, and you get the idea that actually these things are now movable, which for a lot of clients is a weird new idea. And you sort of still get all of it. We're going to give you the opportunity to take the joystick and see which way you want it to do. Once they've gotten onto the idea of reordering, you can move to the idea of substitution. You can't get them to, basically, this is playing the game of, well, you know, if you want to change these things, you want to add new things in, we will go looking for things, and we have to pull these things out, and kind of like playing with blocks. And once you've gotten past those two, they'll have the idea, and they'll go, oh, but we wouldn't have to play with a fixed-size box anymore. You've really got to break these old habits. As I said, a lot of people out there that really hate Agile because they see it as institutionalized micromanagement. And it's really easy to basically relabel everything with, you know, Agile sounding ideas. Or coming up with ridiculous naming contracts that serious people won't take seriously. You know, this is my objection actually to Money for Nothing, is that people sort of like go, well, that doesn't sound particularly great if you're the Department of Health. And really, what you've got to ask yourselves is, when are you wanting to feel the happiest? When are you wanting to feel the most confident? Do you want to have a good night's sleep the moment the contract's signed, knowing that, whatever happens to me, I'm protected by the full extent of the law? Or do you want to feel really happy when the software goes into production? Right? When do you want to be happiness? Do you want sort of happiness now? I've screwed him over. Awesome. Or happiness when the stuff goes into production? And that takes courage, because that's the thing, is people feel good about the fact is, I'm protected, I'm in my little contract blanket. But if we're going to get anywhere, we need to conquer the fear. It's true, I can explain that. I think I actually made it on time, didn't I? Oh, 5 minutes late, I think. Yes.
Hold on.
So there's been a lot of talk on agile contracts, four pieces. Any examples of language that's out there? I know that, you know, I've seen the decks. We have a bunch of language that we use. Where we run into some problems is the kind of the space between the offer and the intent of legal consequences, where it's, you know, what are we really getting and what is my recourse? I know that you have some bullets out there. There's a lot of high-level points. Is there any examples of language that you know of?
There are examples of language, but you kind of hit it with the offer and the acceptance, is because it's really about the language that somebody else will accept. One of the things that I won't go back through as I drew the legal thing is that Venn diagram is that there is a massive set of legal possible ways to describe that thing I want. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a massive difference between making it legal and making it acceptable to you, and that acceptability is massively personal. Do you know what I mean? And it'll come from two places. So it'll come from what you personally want, which will come from A, what you think that clause does, and B, which clauses you are used to. So actually, having seen Mitch's session earlier this morning, I wouldn't mind doing basically the agile contracting anti-patterns, which is this: I think clause A does this. What does it actually do in reality? Do you know what I mean? So there's this, what I would call an epistemic rationality issue. Because when people work in terms of rationality, they're either working instrumentally, which is, given my worldview, am I acting rationally with regard to that? What you see a lot of the times with the agile contracting, especially with the legal people, is an epistemic rationality review, which is that my view of reality does not match how it actually works. Yeah. And where we're in is depending on where you fight in the agile contract front, is that we are stuck with common law. Right? We're stuck with a lot of common law and the fact, and we're also stuck with lawyers, that you think about it. You're a lawyer, you're writing a contract. What do you want to do? Do you want to sit down with some really enthusiastic project manager and learn? I mean, I know Craig does this. It's like, oh, go off and read the Scrum Primer and then come back and write the contract. Right?
Yeah.
Nah, seriously. Oh, did you read the Scrum Primer? Yeah, it was great. Did you like the bit about the butterfly? That was my favorite bit, right? and that's the problem you're going to get. So why kind of come back to what lawyers, I want to bring it a step up rather than the clauses. And why I've had the most success with people is actually coming to the step up. You know, they'll lean five whys. Why are you doing that? Because of this. Why am I doing that? Because of this. Why am I doing this? And this is why I like the bundling approach. So if I was going to talk about terminology, is A, changing the language so we're not locking ourselves in, and B, we're bringing some of the more lean startup stuff in. So in other words, this is the actual business hypothesis that we expect to happen. These are the things we're doing it. So the customer from the very, you can lock somebody down with some scope, but you are taking ownership for those clauses when they go in, which means that you're protected by the doctrine of mistake if it turns out to not be true.
Agree with you 100%. What we've run into is finding lawyers to pen those contracts are few and far between, and even to get them to walk down that path and understand that mentality. And that's why we're, you know, actually having to invent some of that language on our own, and even determining whether or not it's legal and precedence on this stuff is all very challenging. This is a new, and I feel like sometimes like I'm in a dark room with a flashlight.
Yeah, it is. Oh, and then take a the cue to that is to not drop the flashlight. So Henrik Nyberg used to say that Scrum was like walking into a room full of tigers with a flashlight, and he said most organisations drop the flashlight. Now that you're in a dark room full of tigers and you can't see them, right? Yeah. It's not better, right? It's really not better. Precedent, unfortunately, works against this because a lot of the early people that got into this made a hash of it, and so a lot of the case law with precedent actually works against Agile, which isn't great. And this is why I bring the sense-making into it, right? The sense-making is there are stuff we can contract for. There is stuff that is completely compatible for it, and this is this what, again, lawyers like, is they like bright lines, right? Is this like this, or is it like this? And if you look at the parts of your engagement, which are bright lines, contract the hell out of those things and leave some of the other stuff to be exploratory, I think is the key side to it. Beer? I'm just going to put you out of it. Thank you.